Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, for our discussion on Indigenous Australians and Violence, Some Answers. And we have two speakers tonight, both first-timers at the Sydney Institute. Dr. Stephanie Jarrett, who has a PhD in Politics and Human Geography, a graduate diploma in Environmental Studies, and is an Adelaide-based writer. And she is the author of the recently published Liberating Aboriginal People from Violence. And Dr. Gary Johns, who of course was a minister in the Hawke Labor government. He's been a senior fellow at the IPA, at the Australian Catholic University, and now he's working at the Queensland University of Technology in the business school there. And he is the author, not so long ago, of Aboriginal Self-Determination, The White Man's Dream. So we've got two authors here tonight, and Jenna Grundy's got copies of both books for later. But we're going to lead off with Dr. Stephanie Jarrett, and then we go to Dr. Gary John. Stephanie, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, and thanks very much to the Sydney Institute for inviting me here. It's really great to have you all here. There's great public concern about the extent of injurious violence in remote Aboriginal communities. However, largely for ideological reasons, there has been public disagreement for nearly a decade about the causes of Aboriginal violence since the publication of several books which have redocumented the prevalence of violence in pre-contact Australia. These disagreements are slowly declining. While some denial persists, there is now a generalised agreement on some key matters regarding the high level and severity of Indigenous violence that was absent a decade or so ago. First, in pre-contact Aboriginal Australia, interpersonal violence, this is a first agreement, it is generally agreed that in pre-contact Aboriginal Australia, interpersonal violence, including against women, was widespread and severe.
Okay, Stephanie, just hang on a second.
What's happened?
APEC had a slight problem with their microphone, okay. So my introduction's fine, but we're going to start your talk again, okay?
Okay, I think that's okay. Did this?
No, there was a problem with the microphone from here, so I just want to start. You've only gone a minute,
yes,
so let's.
Yes,
so we're
okay.
Going to start your talk again. Okay, let's go.
Oh, well, I'll get a chance to address that. Welcome, everybody, and thank you for coming to hear our talks, and thank you very much to the Sydney Institute for having us as well. There is great public concern about the extent of injurious violence in remote Aboriginal communities. However, largely for ideological reasons, there has been a public disagreement for nearly a decade about the causes of Aboriginal violence, particularly since the publication of several books which have redocumented the prevalence of violence in pre-contact Australia. These disagreements are slowly declining, while some denial persists, there is now a generalised agreement on some key matters. First, there's generalised agreement that in pre-contact Aboriginal Australia, interpersonal violence, including against women, was widespread and severe. Recent presentation and readily available documents of reliable paleontological, that is history, cold case evidence from northern to southern Australia, along with early, including first contact reports, render this pre-contact violence undeniable. Second, there is some agreement that pre-contact violence is still a factor in present-day Aboriginal violence, particularly regarding clearly traditional matters such as punishment, the punishment of spearing, and the imperative for payback. However, persisting difference remains with significant policy implications. it is still considered that white impact factors are uppermost as causal for today's Aboriginal violence. These include loss of land and culture, removal of children, alcohol and other substance abuse, and welfare dependency. Hence, addressing these factors has been considered the path to violence reduction. Restoring culture and land, making amends for child removal, reducing alcohol abuse and welfare dependency, all within the context of self-determination. And for remote communities, this includes on their discrete ancestral lands. True, welfare dependency lowers self-esteem and extends no restraint on negative behaviours. That is, it is sadly compatible with interpersonal violence. True, alcohol is an aggressant. However, most criminologists agree that alcohol increases violence among those for whom violence is already a legitimate response. Hence, high alcohol consumption is inadequate as an explanation for the high level of violence among our Aboriginal Australians. However, there are no major differences between remote and non-remote and declining differences in Indigenous and non-Indigenous alcohol consumption patterns. I know that figures sometimes can be hard to take in, but I will read these figures just the same. In the year 2004-05, in major cities, this is Indigenous alcohol consumption, in major cities, high risk percentage of drinking was 8%, low percent, and a low risk 36.5%, and never consumed alcohol 7%. In remote areas, high risk Indigenous alcohol consumption is 8.2% compared to 8% in major cities, low risk 31.4% compared to 30.5% in cities, and never consumed alcohol 10.6% in remote areas compared to 7% in cities. They're in figures for Indigenous alcohol consumption patterns. When we compare alcohol consumption, I'll just keep to the risky levels here. In 2007, comparing Indigenous to non-Indigenous Australians, we get 12.5 for Indigenous Australians and 10.2 for non-Indigenous Australians. They're quite small differences. And when we get low risk, we get 49% for Indigenous Australians and 63% for non-Indigenous Australians. As far as complete abstention, it's higher among Indigenous Australians, 23% compared to nearly 17% for non-Indigenous Australians. Despite these, I suppose, non-remarkable in many ways consumption rates, Indigenous now close to mainstream levels and patterns, objective measures for violence show little improvement. For instance, Australia's hospitalisation for family violence remains much higher among Indigenous Australians, particularly for female victims, and particularly in remote areas, as these figures show. Now, what I'm going to read to you now is hospitalisation per 1,000 people for family violence in the year 2008-2009 in both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. Major cities for Indigenous people, 2.1 per 1,000. For non-Indigenous people, 0.1 for 1,000. In regional areas, 3.2 for Indigenous, that's hospitalisation per 1,000 for family violence, compared to 0.2 for non-Indigenous Australians. And in remote areas, the difference is most marked, 10.4 per 1,000 hospitalisations for injury from family violence, compared to 0.3. for non-Indigenous remote area Australians per 1,000. And these figures come from the Productivity Commission 2011. when we look at trends within hospitalisation for family violence, again per thousand, for female victims only, it ranges between 6.5 to 7, between there's a range from 2004 to 5 to 2008 to 9. The figures per year are 6.6, 6.6, 7, 6.5, 6.5 across those 5 years. For non-Indigenous Australians across those same years, female victims that have been hospitalised per thousand for family violence. Non-Indigenous Australians, it's 0.2 per thousand each of those years. So that is it's about 30 times less than our Indigenous, than female victims of family violence. The difference in gender victimisation between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians is also noteworthy. If we just focus on Northern Territory, victimisation for assault in the year 2009. And so in an Indigenous male, the rate is... these are raw numbers, sorry. 974 Indigenous males were victim to assault in 2009. There were 3,107 women that were victims of assault in Northern Territory. For non-Indigenous Territorians, it was reversed somewhat. 1,210 males compared to 592 females. So in the Indigenous, it's three times as many women, and the numbers are greater. For non-Indigenous Northern Territories, it's about about twice as many men. So there's a very different gendered pattern as well. And so there's clearly a cultural difference there. It is not just a random problem with welfare dependency or alcohol consumption. These are very definite gendered patterns that are quite specific. Leave it alone looking at anything that's more tightly traditional, such as payback and sorcery, and those particular issues. So I argue that until cultural legitimisers are addressed, including gender relations, gains will remain limited. Also, loss of land and removal of children, both traumatic experiences, do not explain high violence levels. As I wrote in my book, remote Northern Territory, which records one of the lowest levels of removal from natural family, is the region with the highest objective measures for Indigenous include violence, including homicide. And no matter how unfair, and this I've also quoted from my book here, no matter how unfair they, their family or their community have been or continue to be treated by mainstream Australia, it is, in seeming irony, the mainstream context where Aboriginal violence is more effectively suppressed and less tolerated by Aboriginal people themselves. It is in traditional contexts, on lands of dreams and ideals, hard won after years of political battles with white conquerors, where violence is a legitimised tool to uphold law and male dominance. Recent policies and principles which encourage cultural difference and separatism from mainstream from the mainstream as inherent goods, have facilitated the continuity of traditional cultural norms and laws that break universal human rights. The ready embracing of misleading statistics and rhetoric, and I've documented those in my book, about the traditional past have served to delay better policy making here, with self-determination a difficult principle to criticise without being seen as courageous or reactionary. And I put courageous in inverted commas there. What is really needed? Greater comprehensiveness and openness in the provision of statistics regarding Aboriginal morbidity and violence, and greater professionalism in their interpretation. And I've documented why I argue that in my book. greater awareness about the extent and varying kinds of traditional, oppressive and violent practices within remote Australia that are anathema to universal human rights principles, perhaps particularly against women and young people, both young men and women. We need a consistent high prioritisation of women's rights, young people's rights, children's rights over rights to practice Indigenous culture, including, and we need that prioritisation to be higher within our judicial system. And an acknowledgement that expecting the level of cultural change needed is just too hard and too unlikely in the separate community setting. Such settings enhance in-group trust and norms and reduce the adoption of mainstream norms and between-group trust, thus necessitating interventions rather than a kind of process of getting to know one another through more open and compassionate, I suppose, interaction with each other. So, I conclude, above all, the nation needs to embark on a compassionate program of breaking down barriers so that interaction rather than separation is emphasised. Ending the permit system, more visitors, perhaps as volunteers to remote areas, more welcoming programs for remote people. The family resettlement program of the 1970s is an exemplary example of integration, of a successful integration. Sister programs might well too, sister parishes, schools and towns. These programs where there will be an exchange of, Aboriginal families spending time in the city and vice versa, in terms of almost like acting as mentors on how to live in the city, how for education, employment, joining clubs and making friendships, becoming part of a neighbourhood community. And this has been shown to be very successful in Newcastle. And these would be voluntary-based programs, but there's a lot of interest. That program back in the 70s between Bourke and Newcastle showed a lot of interest among the Aboriginal population there. Unfortunately, on the grounds of assimilation, that program was, the funding was stopped and then didn't continue. And I'd like such a program and other similar programs to be given a chance again. So thank you very much to everyone.
Thanks to Jared and Anne Henderson for their kind invitation, and especially to speak with my colleague Stephanie Jarrett on the same issue. I'm going to analyse and remark on Tony Abbott's speech of last week, because he is very likely to be Prime Minister in the very near future, and he has an intense interest in the area, and it's one that we need to take note of. Now, Tony Abbott's address to the Sydney Institute on the 15th of March 2013 was devoted to Aboriginal policy. I applaud his intention to give Aboriginal policy priority in government. Tony will learn, however, that to give an area priority is to set high expectations of fulfilment. Let us see if he's on the right path to fulfil these expectations. Tony Abbott believes that Aborigines should receive an education and get a job, including a job not necessarily on country. Because of these beliefs, we can fairly and accurately label him an integrationist. Having chosen the path, what now matters is whether his policies can achieve the desired outcome. He commenced by observing that, quote, from the very beginnings of British settlement, the health, education, employment and housing standards of Aboriginal people have fallen lamentably short of those of their fellow Australians. And he went on to argue that, quote, this has been a constant through the eras of paternalism and exceptionalism, regardless of whether official policy was neglect assimilation, integration, or self-management, end of quote. Now, these observations, in my humble opinion, fail to distinguish the fact that each policy has or had redeemable qualities, but that each failed or succeeded or is failing because of the external conditions under which they operated or operate. For example, following European settlement, new settlers were, for generations, hostile to or neglectful of, but occasionally paternal towards, Aborigines. These responses by the dominant society to Aborigines at the time were not exceptional. Given prevailing mores, they are about as good a response to those who did not fit in as was possible. They were tough times. The dominant settler society, however, was changing dramatically. In his recent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, A History of Violence and Humanity, Steven Pinker makes the point that Australian society, as part of the Western world, was becoming more civilised. It was becoming, in so many ways, more tolerant of others and less tolerant of violence. The habits of people became less violent. Individuals exhibited greater self-control and were less tolerant of those who lacked self-control. The opportunity for a better relationship between Aborigines and settlers came in the post-World War II era. As the dominant society became more civilised and tolerant, it experimented with other paths for Aborigines. It was the perfect opportunity for Aboriginal integration. Indeed, many Aborigines did integrate, either by securing work and or by marrying a non-Aborigine. By 1930, there were estimated to be fewer than 80,000 Aborigines in Australia. But there were many more who had married in to identify as Aboriginal much later. These integrated Aborigines account for the majority of Australian Aborigines. The dominant story of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal relations in Australia has, in fact, been one of integration. Unfortunately, following World War II, in a post-colonial state of mind, the prevailing policy fashion became exceptionalism and self-determination. These were applied to the minority of Aborigines, predominantly those living in remote Australia and, of course, full blood. As the exceptionalist policies, land rights, permits, land councils, and welfare without obligation started to fail, the rhetoric of encouraging culture became more strident. Culture became the sacred arena into which the white man was forbidden to enter. The Hindmarsh Island secret sacred women's business comes to mind. Culture became the curtain behind which Aborigines did all manner of evil to Aborigines. No fewer than 5 inquiries into Aboriginal child sexual abuse, conducted between 1999 and 2008, found considerable evidence of child sexual abuse by Aborigines and inappropriate sexual activity by Aboriginal children in remote communities. Each inquiry report recommended that Aborigines re-engage their culture. What an extraordinary outcome. Not only is it highly unlikely that any group can return to their culture when the conditions which helped to create it have disappeared, in this case some thousands of years of isolation, but also because Aboriginal culture at its heart was the rule of old men over women. Women were regarded as chattels. It would be repugnant, not to mention illegal, to return to Aboriginal culture. As I argued in my book, Aboriginal Self-Determination, The White Man's Dream, the prescription from these many inquiries was just plain wrong. But the issue is not only one of child sexual abuse. Hospitalisation and injury statistics make it clear that a very large proportion of Aborigines in remote communities live violent lives. The back to culture prescription ignores these horrible facts. The prescription persists because the policy elite have been too frightened to tell the truth. That to save children from violence, Aborigines have to integrate into the dominant society. Culture has been and remains the problem, not the solution. The key issue is to determine policies by which Aborigines can find a way into the dominant society. This should not be difficult, because the largest number of Aborigines has already done so. They had the advantage, however, of knowing there was no way back. The dominant society was intolerant of difference, thereby, in many respects, doing them a favour. By integrating, Aborigines changed. They became like the rest of the community, less violent and less tolerant of violence. Pinker makes the point that entire societies have learned self-restraint, have learned to pause before using violence. The creation of the nation state and the Enlightenment and gentle commerce were keys to lessening violence. And these broad changes also changed individual behaviour. Individuals learned self-restraint. They learned to conform to norms to be good. In her book, Liberating Aboriginal People from Violence, my colleague Stephanie Jarrett explored the conditions under which Aborigines could recover or gain the virtue of self-control. Stephanie and I have concluded that the likelihood of people conforming to the norms to be good and gaining the virtues of self-control are least likely on discrete Aboriginal communities. The so-called healing and pride effects of land rights and self-determination are weak medicine in the face of a badly behaving peer group. Now to Tony Abbott's prescription. If Tony Abbott is to achieve his goal of Aboriginal integration, he must address the issue of bad behaviour and the circumstances under which the chances of changing such behaviour are maximised. After all, Noel Pearson's Family Responsibilities Commission, in which he is in effect remissionising his people, also aims to change behaviour. Pearson hopes to achieve his integration goal in situ. Tony Abbott refers to Noel Pearson's concept of orbits, where economic opportunity is not stymied by an Aboriginal person's continuing attachment to traditional lands. I wish the Pearson experiment well. I also note that Aboriginal traditional owners in the Pilbara and the Kimberley have left country for town and fly in and out to mining jobs. In this respect, Andrew Forrest and Warren Mundine have recently refined the Aboriginal employment strategies, long operated by companies such as BHP and Rio Tinto, by offering a guaranteed job placement to Aboriginal people ready to undergo training. Tony Abbott has promised to fund 4 trial sites to further test the model. This is well and good, but the Commonwealth will continue to build houses and in the middle of nowhere. This policy provides a disincentive to leave for work. Rio Tinto workers left their country and live in town. Housing and settlement, and by implication, the education programs, have to work with, not against, the employment program. In addition, jobs within the 26 designated northern townships, that's the National Partnership on Remote Indigenous Housing Program, would not be necessary if the towns did not exist. And in good conscience, there is no good reason these places exist, other than they are historic remnants of the first contact and mission eras. The question remains, where does the balance of incentives and effectiveness lie in staying or moving? In the race between waiting for the white man to build a house and an economy for Aborigines, or getting out and chasing opportunity, surely getting out is more certain. Waiting for the white man may well lead to generations of further disappointment. Moreover, it may well be impossible to change behaviour precisely because the white man delivers the service. This, after all, has been occurring for 3 or 4 generations. While I respect the views of Helen Hughes at the Centre for Independent Studies of the importance of private property rights, the realpolitik is that Aborigines did not have well-defined living areas, and to identify plots of land is not easy. Furthermore, land councils will do everything in their power to stop it. Most important, property in a worthless area is worthless. Many former farmers know this. In his address, Tony Abbott announced a number of other initiatives. Quickly, Indigenous affairs would be handled within the Department of Minister and Cabinet. In addition to education in English, Aboriginal children would also receive after normal school hours education in high culture. There should be an acknowledgement of Aboriginal people in the Constitution. We should give communities the capacity to use more or less as they see fit money from discontinued programs. The Prime Minister and senior decision makers should spend a week, a year absorbed in the real life of Aboriginal people. And there should be on-the-spot fines administered by truancy officers instead of or in addition to quarantining welfare payments as a way to enforce school attendance. Now, each of these announcements needs to be subject to the simple question, will they cause people to change behaviour for the better? If these changes are not in prospect, then forget it. Anything that does not lead to change in behaviour is a waste. Engagement, empowerment, and collective decisions are weak substitutes for actual mechanisms of behaviour change. I wish Tony Abbott well in government. I ask him to remember that in Aboriginal policy, policy is the enemy. His remark that, quote, we will never be able fully to enjoy our nation's wealth until it is more widely earned by Aboriginal people too, end quote, is a good start. I might say that almost reflexively, a Labor politician would have said shared instead of earned. But unless policies address the behaviour issue, they are a mere shuffling of the deck of policy cards. Aborigines will be as successful as others when the same rules apply and the same constraints on bad behaviour apply. No job, no house, which means that houses should not be made available in areas where there is no economic base. Compulsory school attendance in circumstances where the peer pressure to not attend can actually be overcome. Enforcing mutual obligation, which is very difficult in remote communities, and the full application of the law. Putting a cop in a town is a very crude start to the long journey to change habits and to learn self-control. It is not likely to enforce the habits of the better angels. Thank you.
Well, thanks to our speakers. As I said, we've got copies of Stephanie Jarrett's Liberating Aboriginal People from Violence and Gary Johns' Aboriginal Self-Determination, The White Man's Dream. And so we come to questions. Maybe it's best to direct your comments to one speaker or the other, not to both, but we'll see how we go, and we have to adapt the microphone. So if I can just lead off with a question to Stephanie. You've spoken in your, you've spoken here and you've written your book about Aboriginal violence, and you've given some statistics tonight. But as I understand, the levels of incarceration of Aborigines in the Northern Territory, Western Australia, parts of Queensland are very high. So presumably there's a high number of prosecutions and a high number of convictions. So this doesn't seem to be the answer to the problem. So what do you say about the criticism that there are too many Indigenous Australians behind bars? Now, if you just stay up here after you answer that. Yeah. Just talk into the microphone.
Maybe just hold the microphone.
No, it's got a Sky News on it.
There are many things that can be said about it, but there are two key issues there that come to mind, and that is, yes, the incarceration rate is high, but per crime, there's little difference between the rate of incarceration for violent crime compared to non-Aboriginal offenders, and also the sentences tend to be a little shorter for Aboriginal offenders. So the treatment within our judicial system is, if anything, slightly more to the lenient side. It, at times it has been very much towards the lenient side in terms of traditional culture being a mitigating circumstance for sentencing. The intervention, the Northern Territory Emergency Response Act has tried to address that. It's yet to be seen how effective that is. There was another factor. You saw that as one of the, I suppose, a strategy of imprisonment. Well, I think it's at the wrong end. We need to be looking at that's a tragedy that we are having to respond to in terms of imprisonment. I remember in my field area I compared services, the service rate response between non-Aboriginal and Aboriginal people in my field area when I spent a year in field for my PhD. There was a similar service use level for domestic violence, but for the non-Aboriginal domestic violence, it was going to a counsellor or speaking to one's doctor maybe about it. For the Aboriginal people, it was far too late. It was in hospital. It was in the police station. It was in prison. And so we need. One could ask if it was considered a problem to be, an emotional or a human problem rather than a medical problem or a crime problem. And Aboriginal people took themselves to get help. That's one of the factors that would be a very good way of addressing that. How do we get to that point? Yeah.
Okay, so there's a question down there. Just don't stand in front of the camera. No, Gary, if you just get up and stand next here. Yeah. So who's your question to? Yes, who to?
Oh, look, really either way. No, Gary, you didn't ask that. Look, my fairly limited experience going to remote areas, one in particular, Yuendumu, it seemed a pretty basic problem there to me. They've got a wonderful community there, but they've put two opposing tribes in the same town. And the two tribes want to kill each other. So you can't educate them. I'm sure one tribe is violent to the other tribe's women, and so on and so forth. And it just seems that we don't understand that. What bureaucrat or whatever put two opposing tribes in one area? I'm sure that happens continually.
Just doing this for the micro, there's a suggestion that in certain towns, rival tribes are put in the same township.
Yeah, this was an issue in pre-contact times, and the way that the non-fighting unit was the clan. And that was even within the same peoples, for example, the Yolngu people, and I just mentioned them because Moore has written about that aspect, and that was by W. Lloyd Warner in the 1920s. He looked at that and analysed it in his book, The Black Civilization. I think that's a cultural problem, that you have to live in small, discrete communities in order to prevent fighting is a cultural problem that we need to address. So ultimately, putting people together in a larger town, yes, it will create violence. It can even create conflict within a women's shelter. When people, women from various tribes are in the same women's shelter, it's very hard. But ultimately, that is just a very difficult way to be in the 21st century, including for Aboriginal people. It's very limiting, particularly young people. Young people, young Aboriginal people are like young people everywhere. They're 21st century people that are craving for the modern world. To actually have to stay on small clan lands as one's life is very difficult. So that's where we need.
Gary, do you want to make a comment on that?
Yes, just briefly. This raises a question of investing. It's the investment that's killing Aborigines. So the Commonwealth government 5 years ago said it would invest over $5 billion in building houses in 26 communities across northern Australia, discrete Aboriginal communities. They are recollectivising Aborigines, and 24 of the 26 communities are old mission stations or old feeding stations. I found two that had a possible economic base, but the rest have none. Now, I just want our politicians to say, what is the purpose of this collectivisation? I already know what the bureaucrats are saying. They've given up on servicing 1,200 small communities. So to split your two warring tribes and make two more, we've done all that. We did that back in the outstation movement in the 80s. So the wheel comes round again. We're recollectivising. What is the point of this exercise? If it's possible to use the 26 large establishments, each with a school and a post office and all the rest of it, as a jumping off point into the wider community and economy, that's okay. But I haven't heard anyone say that.
Okay, so there's a question here. Yeah. Just both stand on either side. Yep, Gary, just come over.
Yep.
Yes.
Me?
Yep.
My question's for Gary Johns. I spent quite a bit of time up there in Central Australia, so I've seen a lot of what you're talking about firsthand, in depth. And I met Tony Abbott in summer of 2011, which was particularly violent in Alice Springs. And he asked me, you know, what is the way through all of this? And I said, well, the first thing you've got to get over is white man's guilt, because you've got a lot of issues there where the bureaucrats or the people with you know, whether they be police, whether they be teachers, whatever, they won't do things for fear of being told that they're racially prejudiced. So my question specifically goes to the children, which I've seen in absolutely appalling circumstances. Now, one of the...
That'll be brief.
Yeah. She's started a program where she's actually taking the children and putting them around Australia in different... in private schools. My question is the elephant in the room. These kids need to be out of those environments, and they're not being helped, and it's going to take too long. We'll lose another generation. Should they go? Should they be taken again, in inverted commas, should they be put into schools around Australia and a different approach to the kids be set up?
Okay, so should children be taken and put into schools? Yeah.
They shouldn't be taken and put into schools. They should be encouraged. Sorry, they should be encouraged.
Okay.
Well,
okay. Can you just try and speak up? Let's go.
Children and their parents should be encouraged to send their children from those communities to places where the peer pressure is for a different sort of outcome. Stay, do your homework, work 6-8 hours a day or whatever. So the point I'm making over and over again is, if you have a little toolkit of programs which your public servants will give to you, and you honestly think they will not change a child's behaviour, then don't keep playing that game. Now, there are a lot of good programs around by good private individuals who are paying out money to get kids out of remote communities and into a different environment and peer group. I'd like to think that's the way out of this. But if you keep building houses in the middle of nowhere in those remote communities, you can see the pressure to return, which is not necessarily a sensible thing.
Right, so there's a question here. Don't set up. Yep.
Gary Johns, in an Abbott government, in terms of Commonwealth program delivery to remote communities, what role or influence do the land councils have, do you think, in the things that you're talking about?
Yeah. The land councils still have a great deal of power. They don't want to see long-term leases on Aboriginal land, native title land. They seem to be getting in the way of allowing the possibility that an Aboriginal family might have a sufficiently long-term lease or a privately owned plot of land where they could build a house, raise a mortgage, and so on and so forth. We just need the politicians to tell the story further down the track. The story is, the long-run story of Aborigines in Australia is their integration into the wider community. And if we can just have some discussion about that, then the policies will fall into place. But at the moment, we're in this sort of exceptionalist period where we say, oh, these people are different and special. They are different. They're killing each other. Now, if you want to save lives, then get the kids out of there and make sure that they are well looked after and that they have support and so on and so forth. But I think integrationists will save more Aboriginal lives than separatists will.
Linda, say there, Gary, just stay where you are. Linda Burney was saying on ABC Radio yesterday, I think, yesterday, that Indigenous Australians had this particular attitude to land, and therefore they didn't want to leave that land. So how do you both respond to that? Because on that basis you would stay where you came from, and not only would you do so, but you would want to do so.
Aborigines have been leaving their land for generations, for work and play. And Rio Tinto is hiring traditional owners, that is people who have successfully claimed native title in Pilbara and the Kimberley, and left. So they have, if you like, the heritage sitting there, like Dad's farm in Western Victoria, which we don't own anymore, but I could go back if I wanted to. So those people can return to the Kimberley, but their real life is in a town, in a house in Broome or wherever, and they fly in, fly out to the mines, just like any other workers. That's, if you like, the way.
Yeah, I fully agree that these lands can be sacred, but that doesn't mean to say you have to live your life there. There are many other aspirations that many Aboriginal people have, or if they had them, the violence would go down. There are also Aboriginal people that can't leave those lands because it's too dangerous to leave them. For instance, an Aboriginal woman, if she has violated her husband's order, gone against her husband's order for whatever reason, and, or if he's violent towards her, might desperately want to leave. But if she leaves, the culture in some parts of remote Australia is that he has the right to punish other members of her family. So she stays. To reduce the level of violence. Compliance, and I've written about this in my book, compliance to harsh cultural oppressive practices is a way of avoiding violence, and one of those is to stay on your land. And it's just like when non-Aboriginal people have to leave a violent relationship, that is often the most dangerous time. And so we have to assist Aboriginal people in that victims in that very difficult process. And that also applies to young Aboriginal men. There are young Aboriginal men that are leaving outback areas and going to the towns, and we see them as young men acting up because they're not used to our law. But those young men need a lot of support in that city or town, and need our understanding, towns such as in the Pilbara or Broome. Because if they go back, they are liable. They are liable to some sort of traditional punishment or perhaps initiation that they just don't want to undergo. These are real problems faced by 21st century young people. We need to know about them. They are written about in government reports, but we need to be reading them and coming out more about with them.
Yeah. Now, we've got to be quick. There's a question there and there's a question there.
Some years ago, there were some reports of sewage in the backyard of Aboriginal houses and various places in the Northern Territory, and the army was sent in to clear it up. Now, the screams and yells from Aboriginal spokespeople in Victoria and Melbourne, Sydney, was absolutely, enormous. Well, if I've got sewage in my backyard, I don't care who clears it up.
So the suggestion is that some of the criticism of the intervention which led to the army doing certain work was unfair, and that the local Indigenous people may have wanted this done. I think that's... So, yes. Anyone got any question about point about intervention?
I think, in many ways, the intervention was needed. Violence is an emergency. Children's suffering and neglect is an emergency. Not having enough money for food is an emergency. Sewage is an emergency. So on those levels, I agree with the intervention. And as somebody, I think it was Francesca Milan, anthropologist, and Sutton as well, were saying it drew a line in the sand. We cannot go on like this. And on the other hand, the intervention is a very harsh way, and my book says it's not the long-term way that I want any Australian to be treated. So we need to have a process of integration, so we don't need these specific, race-concentrated interventions. Yeah.
Can I just mention a little case study? If an Aboriginal family has a contract with a provider to fix the sewage, well, they should fix the sewage. But some of the contracts are crazy. So the Telstra is supposed to respond to a public telephone booth in the middle of the Western Australian desert within 3 days. So they get there within 3 days, they fix it, and then someone has an argument with his girlfriend over the phone and smashes the phone. The week after, Telstra comes back. And comes back and keeps doing it. I think this is stupid behaviour. So, yes, in the first instance, of course, we have to fulfil the contract, but just we've got to stop this. This is crazy. These places are not viable. We shouldn't play with people's lives by suggesting they are.
There's a question here. Yes?
Question for Gary. How confident, Gary, are you that Tony Abbott's going to tackle the question of the remote communities? I asked him a question last week about... the problem of getting Aboriginal communities into mainstream as opposed to past failed policies of isolationism.
Okay.
And referred me to Warren Mundy. So,
okay, so if he's elected, how confident would you be that Tony Abbott could manage the problem of remote communities?
Okay, well, he's a good, intelligent man with a good heart, and he does visit those places. Now, that's a good start. But he has to disown policies, and that's going to be the tough bit. And I think it'll be easier, less wasteful, less expensive, fewer lives lost, if he can more honestly and openly disown the investment in places without an economic base, more openly talk about getting children out of there. Now, he can do that. He can do that in the... last 3 or 4 years of the Howard government, ministers began to talk about integration. So you see how the language does change and the policies will follow. It'll take some time, but gosh, if Tony can't do it, I don't think anyone else can.
We'll go to Duncan. Yeah, sir, Gary, come back. Yeah.
Right. Yep. We've just had the appointment of the first Indigenous leader of a government in Australia. How significant do you think this is, and particularly do you think it will lead to more involvement of Indigenous people in the actual policy making that does affect them directly?
Now, Adam Giles was interviewed on 7:30 report. I forget the actual words, but it went something like, from the interviewer, what will you do, Adam Giles, as an Indigenous person? That was different. And Adam said, nothing. I'm an elected official. I'm going to do what politicians do. So it was just so disarming. It was wonderful. So he'll get on with the business. Now, the really difficult part for Adam and say, Bess Price, Alison Anderson, and the two other Aboriginal members of the government, is to talk to their own people. Sometimes you can do it to another suburb. If you're a Labor person, you can have a go at the blue rinse set, and vice versa. But when you're Bess Price, it's difficult to do it to 200 cousins in Yuendamu. She has to have a very tough conversation to them about where their best future lies. Now, sure, involvement, engagement, all that sort of stuff is basically a sop to not have an honest conversation. Aboriginal people love engagement. It means sitting in a committee all day and being paid to do so. And then the leaders go out and do the deal with the white man. That's been going on for 30 years. There's nothing new in that. So, it's good that Adam and Bess and Alison and others have the reins of government, if only because everyone will then see that because you're an Aborigine doesn't mean to say you have the answers. Only the right policy will determine whether people have a better life.
There's a question here.
Yep. My question is to Dr. Jack, and I just wondered if you had any observations about regional or even district by district differences or longitudinal. Like, I know a community, Kamaragunja, used to be a Christian mission. I could be ignorant, but folks I know, I'm not aware of any violence in that place. Is that true? Are there pocket by pocket contrasts or not?
Yes, there are. And it is, there are very historical reasons for that, more than pre-contact reasons for that. I think it's a good question. I would like to know more. But years ago, I had the opportunity as a postgraduate student to visit Menindee and Wilcannia. And there was a very stark contrast between the well-being of those people, and it was because both a harsh history that both of those peoples had endured, and I can't remember the exact details, but the Wilcannia people mostly underwent a kind of involuntary separation from their lands in a post-mission era, and it was and so there's a lot of I suppose anti-white sentiment among those people, as well as a lot of anti each other. They're overall lovely people there, but overall there's a lot of anger there and a lot of disaffection among the young people. And there was a white population. There were mostly service people, very sympathetic, but mainly outsiders, and it was declining. In Menindee, I took the opportunity just to do a little bit of chatting, and I walked down one of the streets there, and there was an elderly woman there watering flowers, beautifully dressed, and I got chatting about how does she know the Aboriginal people of this town, and she said, our Aboriginal people are the best Aboriginal people. And the relations and the well-being was just so different. These Aboriginal people refused to be kicked off their lands, and it was near Menindee, and and they just sat on that river and not really knowing what to do. I don't know the numbers. It was a small number, I don't know, a dozen, 20. And the white people took not only pity, but they found these people were admirable and started giving them jobs. And very quickly they became part of the general community. And they had their own, they did have their own separate services that were implemented during the self-determination era. But they weren't really, the Aboriginal people weren't really comfortable with them because they said, well, there's white young people here that aren't employed too. Let's get them onto our CDEP. And then when they had the 1988 bicentenary ball, there was a high percentage of Aboriginal people at the Menindee ball than white people, I was told. But they really went for it. They were very proud of their Aboriginality. But they, so just that's a history, that difference in a, so it does have a historical link of a more integrated, right, versus an angry, and there's colonial links and mission links, but it's, in a way, it's a positive story.
We've got time for one last question up the back, got to be quick, yep.
Thank you for your talk. I'm aware just of the remote communities to west of Alice Springs and Northern Territory, but really none of the others. If people were to leave the communities and they cut back the housing and so on, where would you imagine those people going to go and live?
Question, do people leave the remote communities, where would they go and live?
Well, I'm certainly not suggesting wholesale out-migration. I think it really is the children who will go elsewhere. And we do know that almost all Aborigines in remote areas circulate very widely. So they do have contacts in town and elsewhere. That's the good thing. The point is to have those kids make best advantage of getting out and moving around and getting into a better place. So they'll make their own contacts like any migrant does. That's the mechanism, I think, migration. I mean, talk to Irish people. I mean, they know when things are bad at home, you get the hell out of there. That has to be the message. It doesn't mean to say you're any less of an Aboriginal person or an Irish person or whatever. But if there's no job there, you go. If the education is poor there, or if the chances of you passing your exams, which are not set by communities, they're set by individuals, then you get out and go somewhere else. Now, that's a reasonable conversation that we should be having.
So just to sue, I mean, the implication would be if people leave the remote areas where there's a higher level of violence, would there be less violence in the areas where they go? I mean, what does your research tell you about that?
I don't think that would happen automatically. I think there needs to be a process of welcoming and integration into that township. But the Bourke to Newcastle certainly demonstrated, and it didn't look at violence, but it did look at school truancy declined dramatically. Employment went right up. Health factors went right up, and the sense of well-being as a person increased as well. You know, measures of self-esteem. There are some indications, though, that behaviour, these are more anecdotal. It really needs to be done on a bigger level. But there are some very strong anecdotal evidence that violence changes in the one person when they are in a remote community compared to when they are in the mainstream community. The anthropologist David McKnight picked up that there was a white Aboriginal man, I think he mentions more than one, would start dating a white young woman and react perfectly fine in the urban area. You know, Darwin would take it, for instance, and would take her to his community on Mornington Island, and he would start to be violent towards her because that's the norm. And also, Joan Kim, in her book, A Fatal Conjunction, opens that book and also opens her thesis that she was speaking to some of her very urbane students, postgraduate women, very, very effective and integrated seemingly within the city, and would not tolerate violence. But when they go home to their traditional lands and their families and their relatives, they will tolerate and expect violence to be committed against them. And they said that's just what happens, and that's what you just have to put up with it. So it isn't even a trend. I'm not violent here. I don't tolerate violence in the urban area, the mainstream area. When I go home, it's to be expected, or when I go home, I will be violent.
Many thanks. Look, I know there are other questions, but it's the hour's up, and we really should conclude. We're happy both Dr. Jarrett and Dr. Johns' papers will be published in the Sydney papers online. We'll run papers that are slightly longer than the presentations they've given. But for tonight, I just should say that both have done very important work and courageous work too, in rather unfashionable areas when you're dealing in universities and similar bodies these days. Stating some of the comments that have been made tonight takes a degree of intellectual courage, and we're very pleased that they've done it in the past and they've repeated their comments here tonight, and what is obviously a very serious problem in Australia, so far intractable, but not necessarily intractable. And what we've seen tonight is two different ways of looking at the problem, with similar ways, but slightly different, and with a fair degree of empirical research associated with each of them. So well done to our speakers tonight, and I'm sure we'll return to this topic in the future. But tonight, well done. Well done, Gary. Well done, Rick. Well done, Stephen.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.